This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 130, The War for Empire. So just a couple of quick notes before we get into things today. I apologize. I mentioned in the last bi-week episode that I was moving, and that turned into a much bigger problem than I expected it to, and then I got sick and couldn't talk, which makes podcasting more difficult. Also, a quick reminder that I encourage everyone to join hopfulmedia.com.co to support this podcast. Even those of you already supporting me on Patreon should make that switch to make sure you keep getting the ad-free and exclusive content. This goes double for anybody with an iPhone. Apple has started charging a 30% fee on all Patreon subscriptions if you use their app. So save some money and support this show at hopfulmedia.com.co. Anyway. In the last episode, I told the story of Antigonus Monophthalmos' war against Eumenes of Cardia. The two faced off in northern Persis, near the city of Gabene, in a pair of battles. In both instances, Eumenes dealt catastrophic damage to the Antigonid army, but Antigonus' forces held the field, and on the second attempt, Eumenes' officers turned against him. Eumenes was executed, as were some of his traitorous commanders, and Antigonus orchestrated a purge of prominent satraps and Macedonian officers in the upper satrapies. Fearing the same fate, Seleucus, the rightfully appointed satrap of Babylon, fled from his province to seek refuge with Ptolemy in Egypt. Seleucus and Ptolemy warned their comrades, Lysimachus, the satrap of Thrace, and Cassander, regent to the 8-year-old King Alexander IV, that Antigonus was attempting to take the whole empire. The four of them prepared to face off against Antigonus in yet another Macedonian civil war, just months after the Second War of the Diadochoi concluded. After replacing Seleucus with his chosen candidate for satrap in Babylon, Antigonus took his whole army, looted several treasuries across northern Syria and southern Anatolia, and occupied Cilicia for the winter. Realizing that this probably meant that the empire would either be seized entirely or collapse, Ptolemy, Cassander, and Lysimachus reached out to their newest rival with a plan to balkanize Alexander the Great's empire without giving anybody too much power. The Western overlords demanded that Antigonus cede authority in Cilicia, Lycia, and Cappadocia to Cassander, Phrygia to Lysander, and northern Syria to Ptolemy. Cassander even sent troops to occupy Cappadocia before the agreement was offered. Antigonus responded by telling his former friends to prepare for war, dispersing agents into the west to try and raise smaller local powers against the Triple Alliance. He also sent his nephew to immediately besiege Cassander's men in Cappadocia, and sent another messenger to treat with Polypherkon, the failed regent who was still trapped in the Peloponnese. All of them started hiring every mercenary available between Italy and India. As spring of 314 BCE approached, Antigonus went to Phoenicia with as much of the money confiscated from Asian treasuries as he could transport, and recommissioned the Phoenician shipyards. The only city that refused him was Tyre, and since Alexander the Great had built a causeway between the former island and the mainland, besieging the once impregnable city was something Antigonus could just leave to his subordinates, while he himself took the bulk of the army south through Palestine. He besieged the cities of Gaza and Joppa, the primary Ptolemaic strongholds that acted as a buffer between Asia and the Sinai crossing, and while Antigonus was besieging Palestine, the rest of the Western Empire exploded. Cypriot Salami sided with Ptolemy, but most of the island's other petty kings joined Antigonus, and immediately set to work on kicking Ptolemaic influence out of Cyprus altogether. Cappadocia immediately fractured, with some cities taking Cassander's side, and others sticking with Antigonus as armies from both competing generals besieged one another in different cities. Polypherkon's son broke free from his siege, went to Antigonus outside of Gaza to pick up some money and some mercenaries, then went to help his father break out and restart the war in Greece. Seleucus and Ptolemy's brother Menelaus went to Cyprus to suppress the Antigonid kings, while Asandros, the satrap of Caria, also declared for Ptolemy and received a company of Athenian mercenaries as thanks. All the while, Greek city-states and islands declared this way and that, and small clusters of ships were sent to Antigonus, Ptolemy, and Cassander alike in a chaotic blitz of city leadership, taking bets on which of Alexander's former generals was most likely to come out on top. Polypherkon and Cassander both had multiple small armies marching across Greece, raiding local countrysides, and seizing whichever fortresses and cities they could as the opportunity presented itself. One minute they're in the Peloponnese, then they're in Thessaly, then the Peloponnese again, or maybe Boeotia. If Diodorus has his order of events correct, it was utter chaos. Local governors were even changing sides faster than the armies could actually reach them, leading to at least two examples of Ptolemaic invasion forces arriving at their destination, discovering that everyone was friendly, and then moving on to the next target. Eventually, the Ptolemaic admiral Polycletus caught word of an Antigonid force marching from Lycia toward Caria, and set up an ambush near the city of Aphrodisias. Polycletus's sailors and marines went ashore and hid in the surrounding hills, waiting for the Antigonid army to pass by with a small fleet from Rhodes carrying their supplies along the coast. As the army passed, Polycletus's troops surged forward on the unsuspecting Antigonids and defeated them quickly. Then, when the Rhodian ships caught up, Polycletus's fleet ambushed them as well. Ptolemy actually tried to leverage this victory into a quick peace deal with Antigonus, who, outright refused and continued to besiege Gaza. Toward the end of 314, the Western Alliance scored a surprising political and strategic victory when Polypherchon's son switched sides and joined Cassander, effectively splitting Greece between Cassander in the north and Polypherchon in the Peloponnese, although the son died besieging Sicyon not long after making his defection. The next year, Greece itself remained chaotic, even though the hypothetical boundary between pro-Cassander and pro-Polypherchon territory had mostly stabilized. Individual Greek poleis started using their allegiance in the war to exercise older boundary disputes. If your neighbor city went with Polypherchon and you wanted some of their farmland, you could now go with Cassander and have a perfectly valid cause for war. What could go wrong? Well, about 24 tiny individual city-on-city wars in Greece, like we're back at the beginning of the classical period, is what could go wrong. But this wasn't really a war for Greece. The constant shifting micro-sieges of southeastern Europe were a sideshow to the greater war for imperial power. And as the new campaign season dawned, the Western coalition made a play to drag Antigonus into an expensive quagmire in Caria. When the local satrap Asandros declared for Ptolemy, he received mercenaries. But by 313, the Cypriot rebellion had largely been defeated, and Seleucus's fleet carried Menelaus and the main Ptolemaic army over to Anatolia to assist Asandros. Not wanting to be left out, Cassander also dispatched his army to Caria. Much as they had in Greece, things in this new theater quickly became a mess of different armies from both the Allied and Antigonid sides, bouncing back and forth between coastal cities and neighboring islands, assaulting and seizing whichever little slice of territory happened to be available at the time. Ptolemaus, the Antigonid general in Caria, broke his army up into winter quarters early that year. See, his own father had died and Ptolemaus was making plans for the funeral when he decided that the situation in southwestern Anatolia was too disjointed to really press their luck as the weather turned against them. In response, some of Cassander's generals plotted an ambush on the divided Antigonid host. But this is a civil war, and civil war means mass desertion from both sides. Ptolemaus received few deserters from Cassander's side who knew about the plan, so he flipped it on its head, recalling troops from winter quarters and ambushing Cassander's generals in the field, capturing many of the key officers in battle. Antigonus himself was falling victim to a pattern that listeners of this podcast should be very familiar with. He ruled the empire from the Mediterranean to India and Central Asia, and Anatolia was engulfed in war. But Antigonus himself really wanted to invade Egypt. He just didn't have the manpower or ships to break further than Gaza. So he withdrew to northern Syria, probably a base at Damascus or Carhi, and told his son Demetrius to hold that position with part of their army. Antigonus had intelligence that Ptolemy was preparing a large army in Egypt for an invasion of Palestine any day now, but the situation in Anatolia and Greece was too chaotic to leave unattended. So Antigonus the One-Eyed went north and left Demetrius in command of Syria along with a small council of veteran generals who had fought in Alexander the Great's campaigns. Some of the only veteran leaders Antigonus personally trusted. Demetrius was just 22 years old, and these were men that Antigonus hoped would guide his son through the early stages of leadership. Meanwhile, the general of the East was trying to drive a wedge through Anatolia by crossing from Cilicia into Greater Phrygia in order to split Cassander's army in half. Unfortunately, early autumn snowfall in the Caucasus heavily delayed those plans and caused many of Antigonus's men and horses to die in the freezing mountains. He did make sure that a Phoenician fleet sailed up to Cilicia to prepare for an early offensive the next year, but he wisely chose to go into winter quarters as soon as the Antigonid army reached Phrygia at all. And after 2.5 straight civil wars of mostly being here for moral support, Lysimachus, the satrap of Thrace, gets to do something. While wintering in Phrygia, Antigonus sent envoys across the Hellespont into Thracian territory. The region had never totally accepted Macedonian rule in the first place, and some Thracian parties were more than willing to accept Antigonus's help, even if they did know that they were probably going to fight Antigonus later themselves. As winter came to an end, the Thracian cities of Collantia and Istria revolted from Lysimachus and used Antigonid's silver to hire Scythian and inland Thracian mercenaries. The rebel army assembled near the Greek colony of Odessus in modern Bulgaria. Lysimachus chased them down and fought a very lopsided battle, where large numbers of Thracian infantry switched back to the Lysimachid side before conflict even began, and the Scythian horse archers suffered massive damage at the hands of mounted lancer cavalry. The satrap of Thrace followed this up by besieging the city of Collantia directly, but just as the siege was getting started, they received word that an Antigonid army had crossed the Black Sea from Cappadocia to relieve the Collantians. Fortunately, you don't actually need a ton of manpower to keep a siege going. You really only need the full army there when you want to try and break the siege. So, a small number of Lysimachid troops stayed behind while the satrap himself took most of the army to meet the Antigonids before they could plunder his countryside. Instead, as they crossed the Balkan Mountains, Lysimachus discovered none other than the Thracian king Suthes III guarding the pass. Antigonid troops were coming, but the one-eyed general had convinced Suthes to go back on his peace deal with Lysimachus. Lysimachus wasn't having it, and neither were his soldiers. Many of these men had been fighting Suthes' Odrysian kingdom for almost 20 years at this point. The Lysimachid army got into formation and charged with unexpected ferocity, killing many in the Odrysian army and forcing Suthes to retreat back into his own kingdom while Lysimachus continued south. He found the Antigonid host shortly after they disembarked and before they could set up any fortifications. The Lysimachid army overwhelmed them too and chased the Antigonids back out of Thrace, capturing several of their generals in the process. In an entirely different sea, Antigonus had also dispatched another fleet to shuttle his forces across the Aegean and reinforce Polypherkon to better collect intelligence about Cassander's movements in Europe. This expedition was much more successful than their counterparts in Thrace and toppled most of Cassander's remaining strongholds in the Peloponnese. They were aided, in part, by another distraction in the north. The kingdom of Epirus, despite aiding Cassander in the last war, resented his execution of the old queen, Olympias. So now, they decided to side with Antigonus, and the Epirote king gathered a sizable army right on Macedon's own border. Cassander's forces clashed with the Epirotes twice and achieved decisive victories on both counts, even capturing the Epirote king and sending him to Cassander in chains. This victory turned the Greek region of Aetolia to Cassander's side, but the rapid Antigonid advance through the Peloponnese was enough to spook Asandros back on the other side of the Aegean in Caria. And at this point, I really do apologize for how this war goes and how little I'm able to describe the events. It's just this giant sequence of cause and effect where the surviving sources haven't preserved a lot of detail. And I could just run through the major battles and gloss over everything in the middle, but I hope this at least helps make the Third War of the Diadochoi make sense from beginning to end, even if it's a little light on action. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. After losing a few more battles in his own territory, the Carian satrap surrendered to Antigonus, and his army switched sides, which I assume now includes the Athenian mercenaries first hired by Ptolemy. But this was all for show. Asandros was supposed to give his brother over as a political hostage. Instead, he snuck that brother out of Halicarnassus with a letter to Ptolemy and Seleucus begging for reinforcements. That didn't stop Antigonus from invading and occupying the cities of Caria, though, which in turn incited Boeotia, back in Greece, and most of Thessaly to leave Cassander's side. That left Athens alone among the Greek powers fighting for the Macedonian regency, and prompted Cassander to personally lead a counteroffensive against the Euboean city of Oreus. Antigonus thought this might just be his chance to kill or capture the regent himself, or at least seize control of the Macedonian homeland and the regency office while Cassander was away from home. Antigonid ships converged on Oreus and drove Cassander's army away from the city, only for Athenian ships to arrive and help Cassander destroy the Antigonid fleet, allowing the siege to resume with even fewer outside threats. Still, This was just one city. Antigonus was winning the war in Europe, but locked into a stalemate in Asia. The general surveyed the situation and realized of his primary opponents, Cassander was not just the weakest, but the one most likely to actually fall. So Antigonus withdrew his navy from Greece entirely and started assembling at the city of Chalcis on the Hellespont, as if he were planning to march a large army through the Balkans and assault Macedon directly. This forced Cassander to give up on Aureus and reposition to prepare for an assault out of the east. Except, Antigonus had also made sure that the Greek cities assembled an army of their own to take Macedon from the south. Then, like a series of convoluted plot twists revealed at the end of the movie, Cassander proved to be the better schemer. Instead of going all the way north to Macedon and preparing to fight Antigonus, the regent anticipated this move and went to Boeotia, retaking Thebes, and started driving off the Greeks as soon as they began to march. Seeking more troops, Antigonus started asking cities along the Black Sea coast, like Byzantium, to form an alliance. But each time he found that Lysimachus had either beaten him to the punch or convinced the Pontic Greeks to remain neutral. And that was the situation at the end of 312. Going into 311, the southwestern Macedonian Empire had been surprisingly quiet for almost 2 years. It turns out that the large army Ptolemy had assembled to fight Demetrius was redirected to deal with domestic unrest in his own satrapy. And in early summer of 311, the Ptolemaic army was pulled even further east when Cyrenaica, the Greek enclave in northern Libya, rebelled. This rebellion was defeated quickly and brutally, but even that took time and resources away from the wider civil war. So it wasn't until autumn that Ptolemy and Seleucus were able to act directly in Syria. They began on Cyprus, with Ptolemy leaving Egypt in person for the first time since Alexander the Great's death to crush any lingering rebel sentiment on the large island. He executed several of the petty kings who were still collaborating with Antigonus, and then began the gradual process of ending the Cypriot kingdoms altogether. Rather than replacing executed kings, Ptolemy gave their cities directly to his general, Nicocreon. Then Seleucus ferried the Ptolemaic army across the sea to northern Cilicia for a raid across northern Syria, capturing treasure and enslaving the residents of several cities before going back to Cyprus in an attempt to provoke the young Demetrius. It didn't work as well as Ptolemy might have hoped, but it did work. Demetrius left his elephants and heavy infantry behind and raced across northern Syria as quickly as his cavalry could manage. But they went so quickly that many of the horses died of exhaustion. By the time they arrived in Cilicia, Seleucus was already gone, but only temporarily. Ptolemy and Seleucus circled around, going from Cyprus back to Egypt to pick up a massive army. If you remember back a few dozen episodes, I talked about the Iphicrates reforms in the Athenian military, how they adopted the Egyptian pike, and how that ultimately influenced Thebes and Macedon. So Ptolemy had a large supply of pikemen, even if they weren't the typical Macedonian-style phalangite. 18,000 infantry, largely local Egyptian recruits, and 4,000 Macedonian horsemen marched on Gaza. The advisors Antigonus had left behind uniformly urged Demetrius not to take the bait and wait for his father to come back with more men. But Demetrius ordered his own army to head for Gaza anyway. Diodorus describes the atmosphere in Demetrius's camp as energetic and hopeful. Demetrius himself was exactly what Alexander the Great portrayed in his own propaganda. Handsome, competent, likable, and a young heir to a great conqueror. It was good that his troops were enthusiastic, because they were outnumbered and facing both Ptolemy and Seleucus, two of the most prominent of Alexander's old generals, who remained alive besides Antigonus himself. Demetrius immediately set to work, trying to prove himself as an heir not only to his father, but to Alexander the Great and Philip II. At first, Demetrius's plan sounds a lot like the typical Macedonian battle formation. Cavalry on the right, phalanx in the middle, elephants out in front, light infantry and mixed cavalry on the left. But rather than stopping there, Demetrius concentrated his elephants in front of the left flank. He also positioned thousands of Persian archers in between the elephants. This created a heavily defended wall between the main Antigonid army and their opponents, albeit a human wall. Ptolemy and Seleucus just expected Demetrius to play it safe with a normal formation, and they had to quickly rush troops from one flank to the other on their own side to compensate for Demetrius's innovation. Seleucus and Ptolemy took up position on their own right flank, making sure they would both lead the charge against Demetrius's own position. Seeing the concentration of elephants across from them, Ptolemy ordered his troops to deploy another new addition to the Macedonian battlefield: portable elephant traps. Huge iron spikes held together by heavy chains were stretched out across the battlefield to deter giant charging beasts, while every archer and slinger Egypt could spare bombarded the Antigonid elephant corps. Ptolemy's army charged first, with heavy cavalry at both extreme ends of the line leading the clash on either side simultaneously. This also caused Ptolemy and Seleucus to actually pull more cavalry from their own left to reinforce a second charge on Demetrius. As the cavalry fighting dragged on, the Antigonid elephants charged, only to be caught up in Ptolemy's traps. With whole elephants collapsing in shrieks of pain, Demetrius's cavalry horses started to panic and flee. Unable to regain control of the situation, Demetrius was forced to retreat himself, and the infantry followed their general. When some of the Antigonid officers tried to reclaim the baggage they had left behind, they were ambushed and captured by Ptolemy. It was a stunning loss for Demetrius in his very first battle as overall general. Only about 500 of his men had died, but they were almost all cavalry, including most of his high-ranking officers, and almost two-thirds of the Antigonid infantry were taken prisoner. When Demetrius tried to negotiate for the right to bury his dead and reclaim possessions that his nobles had lost, Seleucus and Ptolemy allowed the burials but refused to give back the loot, on the grounds that Antigonus had never shared the spoils of war when he fought Perdiccas and Eumenes. This was really just honest payback. Demetrius then fled to Phoenician Tripoli to fortify himself and wait for his dad to come with backup. Meanwhile, the Ptolemaic army slowly and methodically worked its way up the Levantine coast, reclaiming many of the Phoenician and Palestinian cities that had fallen to Antigonus in the preceding couple of years. Tyre and Tripoli were the only cities to put up significant resistance this time, and Ptolemy himself settled in to take the former island stronghold for the third time in as many decades, thanks to Alexander's causeway. Back in Greece, the Antigonid cause fractured. Ptolemaeus Antigonus's direct subordinate in central Greece was getting most of their side's funding, which irritated his naval counterpart, Telesphorus. So much so that the admiral sold all of his ships, hired mercenaries, and tried to seize power for himself. He seized the cities of Elis and Olympia in the northwestern Peloponnese, and ransacked the Olympian temples to pay for mercenaries. This is Olympia as in the Olympic Games. This was a major Greek sanctuary, and he was just raiding the temple treasuries. So Ptolemaus turned his army around and marched into the Peloponnese to deal with this domestic uprising, liberating Elis first by way of burning the city's fortified Acropolis to the ground, and chasing Telesphorus out of town. A little further north, Epirus went through a bloody succession dispute that saw a pro-Cassander faction emerge victorious, despite the actual king who succeeded to the throne being hesitant to make that alliance. Still, under pressure from his courtiers, the new Epirote king joined forces with Cassander to invade the neighboring kingdom of Illyria, which had sided with Antigonus. They briefly besieged the city of Apollonia, but were not able to take it, and when Cassander retreated to Macedon for the winter, the Illyrians just pushed deeper into Epirus, claiming more territory for themselves and, nominally, for the Antigonid side. Fighting resumed on all sides in spring of 311 BCE, and continued with a chaotic back and forth all over Greece. Antigonus was rampaging through Caria and Cilicia, trying to get Anatolia in check, and Demetrius was now marching his component of the Antigonid army south into Syria once again for a rematch with Ptolemy. Ptolemy, in turn, withdrew out of Phoenicia and back into southern Syria to try and force Demetrius into a more favorable battleground, with neither side ever quite giving the other what they wanted. Then, the game changed. Demetrius ambushed a Ptolemaic army in the Syrian countryside, and Antigonus decided that Anatolia was subdued enough, bringing the bulk of the army south to assist his son. Both Antigonus's reputation and the size of his army spooked Ptolemy and his advisors alike, so they withdrew back into Egypt. Then, the war sort of ended. Antigonus remembered the siege of Gaza and knew enough about previous attempts not to take his war-weary army into an invasion of Egypt. He had also seen that Greece was proving incapable of outright conquest. In fact, he had sort of realized that early on and started pursuing a policy of freedom for the Greeks, granting the city-states that fell to the Antigonid side more autonomy than they had seen since the rise of Macedon under Philip II. Everyone just sort of agreed that the war needed to end, if only so they could all recuperate for the next round of fighting. So, Antigonus reframed himself as a liberator, and agreed to let Ptolemy and Lysimachus retain control of the satrapies granted to them by Alexander so long as they didn't expand into Syria or Phrygia respectively. Cassander agreed to extend Antigonus's policies of liberation and autonomy to all the Greek cities, so long as a few Macedonian garrisons remained in the peninsula to keep the peace. And Antigonus and Cassander both agreed that they would serve as equals. Cassander held supreme military authority in the west, Antigonus had it in the east. Antigonus had more territory, but Cassander remained regent for the now 12-year-old Alexander IV, and all four combatants agreed to uphold Alexander's right to ascend the throne on his 18th birthday. But I did say the war only sort of ended. No sooner was peace concluded between the four major rulers of the Eastern Mediterranean than all four of them sought out new targets. Ptolemy reinvaded Cyprus immediately, clearly focused on the island's historical role as Egypt's major naval outpost. Lysimachus went back to war against the Odrysian Thracian kingdom and started establishing border fortresses. Cassander still had to settle his disputes with Illyria and Epirus. Antigonus and Demetrius marched off into the desert to subdue the Arab Nabataean kingdom. And you may be wondering at this point, what happened to Seleucus? Well, he certainly didn't go back to Egypt and serve Ptolemy. He was the rightful ruler of one of the empire's greatest provinces, after all. Once Ptolemy had worked all the way north into Tyre, Seleucus requested another favor from his old friend. Permission to leave and take some mercenaries Ptolemy paid for east in order to reclaim Babylon. Ptolemy couldn't spare much, but also the Antigonid army was fully mobilized in the west. So just before everyone else started fighting in the spring of 311, Seleucus started marching east, with 1,000 soldiers on their way to conquer the greatest city of the ancient world. And that will be the story next time. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.